Thekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm your host, and I'm really looking forward to exploring some pretty significant ideas with you today. We're tackling a topic that honestly feels incredibly relevant, maybe even urgent in our world right now. Have you ever, like, scrolled through the news about, you know, tech booms or read about the gap between the super rich and, well, everyone else, and just found yourself thinking, how did we actually get here? What's really driving all this?
Absolutely. And it's easy to feel like the whole global economy is just this huge, chaotic, unpredictable thing. But what if there's actually a logic to it, a systematic way to understand it all? That's really what we're aiming for today. We're diving into Joseph Chunara's A Reader's Guide to Marx's Capital. Mm. Look, this isn't about, you know, dusting off some old book. It's about using it as a living tool, a tool to dissect the fundamental dynamics, the contradictions, even the crises we see playing out in 21st century capitalism. So our mission really is to unlock the core power of Marx's Capital, using Chunara's guide to make it accessible, hopefully giving you a clearer lens to make sense of the world around you.
Yeah. And what makes Chunara's guide so interesting, I think, is his background. He's not just an academic, you know, with a PhD. He's also deeply involved as a socialist activist. And that dual perspective means he really gets the common hurdles, the stumbling blocks people face when they try to read Marx, which, let's be honest, can be pretty dense stuff. Right. So he doesn't just see these theories as like abstract ideas. He sees them as actual tools, tools for understanding, maybe even for thinking about social change. His guide is kind of like a map, you know, a map and a compass to help you navigate capital without getting totally bogged down.
That's a really crucial point. Chunara argues, pretty passionately actually, that Das Kapital, even though it was written over 150 years ago, feels more vital, more relevant now than maybe ever before. He points to things like the 2008 financial crisis, or the just persistent growing inequality we see globally, things that seem to echo the very dynamics Marx identified way back when. So his guide, it systematically breaks down volume one of Capital. It translates these, you know, complex arguments into much more straightforward language. And he's always linking Marx's theory back to what's happening right now, economically and socially. It really helps you get beyond just what's happening to understand the why behind it.
Okay, so let's jump in then. Let's get to the basic building blocks. Chunara, like Marx, starts with something really simple, the commodity. You know, any object like this microphone or maybe the mug you're holding, every commodity has a use value. It does something, right? Keeps your coffee warm, lets us record this. Mm-hmm. But it also has an exchange value, what you can trade it for. So here's the puzzle Chunara lays out. How can we compare and actually exchange totally different things? A microphone, a mug, maybe an hour of an editor's time? What makes them comparable?
Yeah, that's the fundamental question, isn't it? And that's where Marx introduces the concept of value. He argues that what lets us equate these different things, what allows exchange, isn't some like magical property in the object. It's the human labor that's gone into making them. But this is key, not just any labor, it's the socially necessary labor time, which basically means the average time needed to produce something using the average skills and technology available at that time.
Ah, okay. So it's not about how long one specific person took.
Exactly. So if someone, you know, spends 100 hours hand carving a wooden spoon, but a machine can make thousands in that same time, the value isn't based on those 100 hours. The socially necessary time is much, much less. This idea sets a kind of baseline for value in the market, something beyond just individual effort.
That makes sense. It's a really important distinction. And it leads us to something else Chunara explains really well, commodity fetishism. I have to admit, when I first heard that term, I thought, fetishism? That sounds kind of weird. But it actually makes a lot of sense when you break it down.
It does, yeah. It's a really crucial insight. Think about that spoon again, or maybe your smartphone. When you buy it, you don't usually think about all the different kinds of human labor involved, do you? Mining the metals, designing the circuits, assembly line work, marketing. It's vast.
No, you just see the phone.
Right. You see the phone and you see its price tag. We tend to perceive the value as something inherent in the phone itself, like a property of the thing. That's commodity fetishism. We see social relationships between the people that made it, transported it, sold it. We see those relationships as relationships between things. It hides the human effort.
Yeah.
It obscures it. It obscures the whole social process behind production. It makes the market feel like this impersonal force rather than, you know, a web of human interactions. And money then kind of emerges as the ultimate go-between, the universal equivalent, simplifying everything into just numbers.
Okay, so I've got commodities, value based on socially necessary labor time, and money making exchange easier. But here's the really big question, right? The pivot point. If everything is theoretically exchanged at its true value, how does anyone actually make a profit? How does plain old money turn into more money? It feels a bit like magic or a cheat.
It does feel like that. And that's exactly the puzzle Marx wanted to solve. And his solution, Junor explains, is brilliant. It's not about clever trading or, you know, ripping people off in the market necessarily. It's about one very special, unique commodity that the capitalist buys. And that commodity is labor power.
Labor power, not labor itself.
Not the finished work, no. Labor power is the worker's capacity or ability to work for a certain amount of time, say for an 8-hour day. Now, the value of this labor power commodity, just like any other commodity, is determined by the socially necessary labor time needed to produce it, which for a human being means what? It means the cost of keeping that worker alive, fed, clothed, housed, you know, basically ready and able to show up for work the next day. That cost translates into their wage.
Okay, so the wage covers the cost of the worker's ability to work. Seems fair, right? On the surface, anyway. But I'm still not seeing the profit.
Ah. Okay, here's the crucial step. Here's the magic, as Marx might put it. The use of the labor power commodity, the actual working, creates more value than the value of the labor power itself. Let's use an example. Say a worker's wage covers their living costs, and producing those necessities takes maybe the value equivalent of 3 hours of labor in society.
Right.
But the capitalist has bought their labor power for a full 8-hour day. They work for 8 hours, those extra 5 hours. That's unpaid labor.
Unpaid, even though they got their wage.
Yes, because the wage covers the value of their ability to work, the 3 hours equivalent. But they actually work for 8 hours, creating value during that whole time.
Yeah.
That value created in the extra 5 hours goes beyond their wage. That difference, that extra value generated by the worker but not paid back to them in wages, is appropriated by the capitalist. That's surplus value.
Wow. Okay.
And that, according to Marx, is the fundamental source of profit. Not just for one boss, but for the entire capitalist system.
So, surplus value. That sounds like the absolute core of Marx's analysis then. And Junaro really hammers this home, doesn't he? That exploitation isn't just, you know, some mean boss somewhere. It's structural. It's built right into the production process itself. It could be happening even if you feel like you're getting paid okay.
Precisely. It's systemic. And to dig a bit deeper, Marx, and Junaro clarifies this really well, identifies two main ways capitalists try to increase this surplus value. First, there's absolute surplus value. This one's pretty straightforward. You just make people work longer hours.
Extending the workday.
Exactly. Marx looked closely at the big fights over the 10-hour workday in 19th century British factories. By simply extending the working day, even if the daily wage stayed the same, the capitalists increased the amount of unpaid labor time, pulling out more surplus value.
Makes sense. Longer hours, more unpaid time. But, you know, today, at least in some parts of the world, maybe those super long factory days aren't the main story anymore.
Right. Which brings us to the second method, which is arguably more dominant now, relative surplus value. This is more subtle, more sophisticated. This involves increasing productivity, using new machines, automation, better organization, technology, AI, anything that lets workers produce more in the same amount of time or produce the same amount in less time.
Like self-checkouts or robots in warehouses.
Perfect examples. If technology makes it faster and cheaper to produce the things workers need to live, food, clothes, housing for them, then the value of their labor power, the amount needed for their wage, effectively goes down.
Yeah.
Even if their workday is still 8 hours and their wage seems the same in money terms, the portion of the day they spend working just to cover their own wage shrinks.
I see.
Which means the other portion, the unpaid labor time, where they create surplus value for the capitalist, gets bigger, more profit, without necessarily making the clock longer. That's relative surplus value in action, constantly reshaping our economy.
Okay, so capitalists are extracting this surplus value, this profit, through these methods. What do they do with it? Shinora stresses they aren't just, like, swimming in gold coins Scrooge McDuck style. He says they're basically forced by competition to reinvest most of it back into the business. He uses that famous Marx, quote, accumulate, accumulate, that is Moses and the prophets. It's like a system requirement.
Absolutely. It's not really a personal choice for the individual capitalist, not if they want to survive. Competition forces them to constantly reinvest, expand, innovate, find cheaper ways to produce, capture more market share. That drive to accumulate is what fuels capitalist growth. But this relentless accumulation, this drive, has really big consequences for the system as a whole. As capital grows, capitalists tend to invest more and more in machines, technology, buildings, raw materials, what Marx called constant capital, and proportionally less in actually hiring workers' variable capital. Think about automation again.
Right, replacing people with machines.
And this shift isn't just random. It leads directly to what Marx famously called the reserve army of labor, a pool of unemployed or underemployed people. And according to the theory, this isn't some unfortunate side effect. It's actually functional for the system. It puts downward pressure on wages for those who do have jobs, and it weakens workers' ability to bargain for better conditions because there's always someone else waiting to take the job.
So unemployment is kind of built in.
As a regulator, yes.
Yeah.
And alongside this, we see the concentration and centralization of capital. Bigger companies swallow up smaller ones. Mergers, acquisitions. You end up with fewer, but much larger, much more powerful corporations dominating whole sectors of the economy. Think about big tech, big pharma, big finance today. It's exactly that process playing out.
Okay, we've looked at how capitalism works once it's established, but how did it all start? Chunara also guides us through Marx's account of primitive accumulation, and this part really challenges that sort of common sense story we sometimes hear, you know, that capitalism just naturally grew out of people working hard and saving money. Marx and Chunara paint a very different picture.
They really do. It's a fascinating and often quite disturbing look back at history. Marx argues that the basic conditions needed for capitalism didn't just appear peacefully. Specifically, you need two main things. A large group of people who own basically nothing except their ability to work the working class. And another group who have monopolized the means of production. The land, the tools, the factories, the capitalist class.
How were those two groups created then?
Well, Marx points to historical processes that were often systematic and, frankly, violent. Think about the enclosure movements in England, starting way back. Common lands, which peasants relied on for survival, were fenced off, privatized. This drove huge numbers of people off the land, took away their means of supporting themselves independently, and forced them into the cities looking for wage labor in the new factories.
So creating a workforce that had to sell its labor.
Exactly. And add to that, Marx includes things like the colonization and plunder of other parts of the world, the horrors of the transatlantic slave trade, the use of state power, national debt, taxes, all contributing to concentrating wealth in fewer hands and creating this propertyless working class. Chunara emphasizes that these acts weren't primitive as in backward, but primitive as in original or foundational. They were the necessary, often brutal preconditions for the capitalist system to even begin. It's a powerful reminder that this system isn't timeless. It had a very specific, very historical, and often violent birth.
Right. So we've covered a lot of ground here, tracing Marx's core ideas with Chunara as our guide. If we were to try and boil it down, what are some of the absolute key takeaways, the main messages you think listeners should really hold on to from this deep dive?
Okay, well, I think one absolutely central point Chunara keeps highlighting is that capitalism isn't just random chaos. Marx reveals it as a discoverable system with its own internal logic, its own laws of motion, if you like. And right at the very heart of that system, structurally, exploitation, the extraction of surplus value, is the fundamental source of profit. It's not just an occasional problem or about bad apples. It's how the engine is designed to run. That really challenges our everyday ideas about fair exchange in the market.
Yeah, that's a big one. And flowing from that, it becomes clear why understanding class and class struggle is so important in this framework. Society isn't just a collection of individuals. It's fundamentally divided based on that relationship to who owns the means of production. And another key thing, the system is incredibly dynamic, always changing, but it's also inherently contradictory and prone to crisis. That relentless drive to accumulate, which we talked about, it creates huge tensions, inequality, instability, environmental issues that lead to those periodic crises, the booms and busts.
Definitely. And maybe stepping back a bit, Chunara's guide really helps us grasp the ongoing power of commodity fetishism, how our social connections, the human work behind everything, get hidden behind relationships between things, between products and money. We get alienated from the process and from each other, in a way. And that's why, you know, a book from 150 years ago still feels incredibly relevant today. It helps make sense of things like the gig economy, global supply chains, financial meltdowns. The logic is still playing out.
And this isn't just abstract theory, is it? It gives you, the listener, some practical tools. You can start to deconstruct economic news differently. When you hear about making the labor market more flexible or necessary cost cutting, you can see it through this lens as potentially strategies to increase the rate of surplus value extraction.
Right.
You might even understand your own workplace in a new light. seeing management decisions, new initiatives, maybe not just as improving efficiency, but also as ways to maximize the surplus value generated from your work.
Exactly. And beyond the workplace, this analysis can provide a really solid foundation for informing political or social activism. It helps connect the dots, showing how seemingly separate issues, low wages, lack of affordable housing, climate change, might actually be linked to the deeper logic of capital accumulation. Ultimately, I think it encourages a more critical worldview, moving beyond just asking, who's the bad guy here, to asking, what is the underlying system, the structural logic, that keeps producing these kinds of outcomes?
So wrapping up this deep dive with Chinara's Guide to Marx, for me, it really solidified maybe three core things. One, profit fundamentally comes from unpaid labor, from exploitation. Two, capitalism, because of its drive to accumulate, is inherently unstable and contradictory. And three, Marx's analysis, especially made accessible like this, is still an incredibly powerful tool for just understanding the world we live in. Kenora does a great job, I think, of taking Marx out of just dusty academic debates and putting these ideas back into the hands of anyone trying to make sense of things.
And maybe a final thought to leave with everyone. If we accept Marx's historical argument that economic systems like capitalism aren't natural or eternal, but are human creations with specific beginnings, well, that naturally raises a pretty big question, doesn't it? If we created this system, what other ways might we imagine or perhaps even organize our economic lives and our societies in the future?
That's definitely something to think about. We hope this deep dive has given you a clearer, maybe a more critical perspective on the economic world around you. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.